Chapter 20, Fist and Lightning. I knew that this next class would be important. I knew it would take us to another level entirely. And so after some silent sitting and giving and taking, I had the captain go through the poses first. And for the most part, I was silent, just counting out his breaths for him at a medium pace. I knew he would take this as a treat, and that he'd feel fresh when our talk continued about how yoga really works. And so you see, our inborn tendency to misunderstand the people and the things around us escalates to a new level when something seems either very pleasant or very unpleasant to us. We lose control of ourselves, even if we already have some understanding. And the last thing in the world that we can do at that moment of emotion is to recall that it is actually our own minds making us see the things the way that we do. We're stubbing our own toe, but we feel strongly that someone else must be stepping on it. We grasp to the mistaken notion, and then this triggers very quickly a very wrong chain of events. As the master puts it, assailed by what feels good, we begin to like things. Assailed by what feels bad, we begin to dislike things. If you really believe that someone has stepped on your toe, if you grasped to the notion that the corporal is irritating in and of himself, and not because your mind is making you see him that way, then in the very next moment, you begin to feel strong feelings of dislike for this other person. And it works the other way too. The moment you grasp to the idea that another person is nice from their own side, by themselves, and not because your mind is making you see them that way, then you start to have a strong feeling of liking them. So is it wrong to like things? Interjected the captain. I didn't say that. I didn't say it at all, I objected. Nor would the master ever say that. We do like things. We should like things. All of us enjoy beauty, the beauty of a sunset, the beauty of a flower, the beauty of a young child's smile. And here the captain's face fell strangely. Who could say it would be wrong to like it if the sergeant were cured of his drinking and the corporal were freed from his lack of energy? And who could say, on the other hand, that it is wrong to dislike the pain you feel in your back or the pain being felt in the entire world at this moment, for that matter, and want to end them both forever? Why, it is the very purpose of yoga, and you know that. It is why we are here, and your heart tells you so. No, it is not the emotions of liking and disliking that are wrong themselves. Rather, it is a certain kind of liking and a certain kind of disliking. It is liking something the wrong way. It is disliking something the wrong way. It is misunderstanding pleasure or pain. It is a feeling that pleasure or pain happen by themselves from their own side. It is grasping to them desperately this way, forgetting that they appear to us as they do only because our mind makes us see them as pleasure or pain. There was a long pause. But I don't really see the difference, said the captain. Pleasure or pain, whether it exists out there by itself from its own side or whether it's something that's in my mind is making me see it that way, still, we like the pleasure and we dislike the pain just the same. Not the same. And felt as if Katrin had taken over my mouth, my mind. If you stub your own toe, do you stand and strike your own face with your fist? The captain stared at me in a trance, and it began to dawn on him. Power attracts power. When one tree grows tall above the others, lightning comes to strike it. And so as the captain and I were on the verge of understanding how yoga really works, things fell apart. The sergeant went out in the late evening and didn't return for hours. When he did, I was sleeping. But I heard him come in. He didn't go to the room on the side to sleep. Instead, he sat down on the bench there against the wall. The moon was out and a pale light was coming in through my window, surrounding me. And although he was in the dark beyond the moonlight, I could hear him drinking slowly from a jug and setting it back down on the bench and then drinking again. And I felt his eyes on me as he drank. And then there was a shuffle, and he got to his feet. A thrill of fear went through me. He walked up close to the bars, and I could see his tortured face and the red glow of his eyes in the shadows of the bars throwing dark black lines across his body. And then his hand was on the crossbar, and he slid it open, and he came to me. I scrambled up and crouched there on the floor. "Nowhere to run this time," he breathed. He started towards me, and I backed into the darkness of the corner, still crouched like a cat. He stood there in the moonlight, tapped his stick on the floor. "Out here, girl," he said, his tone growing ugly. "You know what this feels like." He struck the stick once more to the ground with a loud crack. I shook my head. I saw the very ends of my long black hair brushed through the edge of the moonlight. And then, before they settled back on me, the end of the stick flew out, thrust straight into my belly. I cried out in pain. "Out here now," he roared. I was shaking all over. I could hardly think, but I knew I would not move an inch to him while I still breathed. The stick made that sickening whoosh through the air and caught me across the face. The blood wet my lips. I licked it dumbly. Long Life began to bark furiously on the other side of the wall. "Now, now," he was screaming, and the stick flew again, and it came to me in a haze that I had to cover up, like Busuku had said. And more blows came, but I turned and crawled into the corner. And then he tore at my hair with his hands, and chunks ripped out, and I curled up tighter with my hands around my hair and my dress. And then Busuku was screaming, "Ravi, Ravi, what are you doing?" And then the stick is just coming down, whoosh, whoosh, one after another, and on my back. And the sergeant is raging with curses, and Long Life is howling my pain for me, and Busuku is tearing at the bars of his cell and crying, "No, no, no." But I just go quietly into my mind to where the master's short book lies, and I begin to sing the verses softly to myself, to the rhythm of the blows. And I was somewhere in the second chapter, I remember, when he stopped from sheer exhaustion, and he dropped his stick and stumbled back to his room there and fell asleep. Chapter 21. Truly, everything is suffering. When the captain came in with the morning light, the corporal took him silently by the arm and brought him to the door of my cell, still thrown open. And I was still curled up, but I had fallen out of the center onto the floor near the stick. I opened my eyes. I could see the captain, and there was his voice, Busuku's voice. It sounded like the voice of a king and not a criminal. "Captain," he said evenly, "if you possess within you still any single shred of integrity, then you will discipline your man now." I heard the captain's breath. I heard it catch in his throat. I saw a hand come down near my face and close around the stick. The knuckles were pure white. And then I could hear the captain dragging the sergeant out of the side room with silent rage, and the sergeant protesting weakly, half asleep still. And then he was thrown on the floor beside me, gasping for breath, and I could see his face down there close to mine, full of fear, trembling. Sergeant, stand up. He just closed his eyes and shook his head. I still couldn't move. All I could see of the captain was his feet and the end of the stick, that evil thing, against the floor. Stand up and remove your shirt. That's an order, now, screamed the captain. The sergeant didn't even open his eyes. The captain's hand came down on the collar and ripped the shirt off his back in a single burst of rage. I saw the end of the stick come up off the ground, and I said to the floor, "No!" And I tried to turn my head up, and I did, and I saw the captain's terrible face and the stick poised in the air. "No!" I repeated, locking him in the eye, looking him in the eye, and his anger turned to me. "Silence!" "No, I will not be silent," I whispered. "I am your teacher, and I say no, put the stick down." The blood drained the rage in his face to pure fury. "I am in charge here. I am the captain." "No," I said again. "Remember your yoga. Remember what makes you see him like this." "I have seen. I see. I can see," he roared. And the stick came up, and I threw my body forward over the sergeant's. I covered him like my child. I felt the warmth there amidst the trembling and the stink of liquor. "Get up! Get off of him!" It didn't even sound like the captain now. The voice was high, hysterical, like a little boy lost in a tantrum. "Remember your yoga," I cried out again. "Remember this!" And the stick came down hard against the floor within an inch of my head, and I could hear the captain sobbing now, and he sucked his breath in. Once, just once, and he screamed with all his might, "Damn!" And the stick came down on my back once. "Damn your yoga!" And my eyes were shut dark in the pain. But I heard him throw the stick down and run outside toward the road, sobbing in pain. And there was the precious little warmth below me, the sergeant, safe, and the warmth of the new blood coming down my back, and I took my rest within the warmth. And after a while, in the silence, the sergeant stirred, and he crawled out from beneath me to the door and out the cell, and he stayed there on his knees and turned around and stared at me, grasping the bars with his forehead up against them, as if he were on the inside and I were on the outside. I closed my eyes and went back to the master's book, to the place I'd left off the night before, and it said, "Truly, every part of our lives is suffering." Chapter 22, A Vessel. The first day, I simply laid on the floor of my cell, on my stomach. I was terribly thirsty. At some point, the corporal came in, held up my head, and helped me drink some water. He looked like he'd been crying, and he was alone. I slept until the late evening, and then I heard footsteps, or rather felt them, with my cheek on the floor, and someone spoke, and it was the sergeant, but I was too far gone to be frightened. "Girl? Oh, girl, don't be afraid now." I tried to look up, but I couldn't. I saw his hands come down, and they set a small clay jar on the floor, and next to it a little dish of something. "Hold still now. We have to move these things." I felt him take my hair gently in his two hands and pull it up off my back. out of the drying mass of blood and pus. And then I felt him carefully separating the pieces of my dress in the back, pulling them down to my waist. "Now this part will hurt, so get yourself ready," he said, "but it has to be done." "I know," he said, faltering. I know how this has to be done to heal. I have seen it before, once." He poured strong liquor from the jug across my back, and it hurt like fire, but I was too tired to cry out. And then he took the little dish in his hands and slowly daubed something into the cuts across my back. It felt cool, like ice from the mountains of my homeland, and it smelled like sandalwood and fresh butter. And when he was done, he set a clean white cloth across my back, softly. He stood, picked up the jug, and there was a pause. And then I heard him empty the rest of the liquor out with the other filth at that hole in the back wall. And then he was gone, and I slept soundly, and the wounds began their healing. It was only after 3 days that the captain returned. He came straight to my door. I was sitting up on the floor, and he asked me if I felt strong enough to come and talk, at least in his room, and I did, and I came. He sat at his desk, and I sat down slowly, stiffly across from him. He pretended not to notice and said, "Well, now, I was giving some more thought to those ideas," and he stopped at the look on my face. "Captain, we can't just forget everything and go on like that." His face reddened and his eyes dropped to the floor. "I know," he said finally. "I'm really very sorry for having hit you." I waited for his eyes to come back up to mine, and there was a pause and some tension. And then I gazed out the window. "It's not really that you hit me," I said finally, trying to sort out my thoughts as well. "That's not what's wrong." And I thought again for a moment. "You see, it's not that you made a mistake. Every student makes mistakes with their teacher. It's part of being a student. If the student never made any mistakes, then you see they wouldn't really need a teacher in the first place. And so, mistakes, like what you did, they're normal. And a real teacher doesn't let them get in the way. No, it's something else." And I frowned a bit, and then it came clear to me. "The problem is, you see, well, it's something the master says himself in the short book. He says, 'And another way is to ask the master for their blessing.'" "Another way? Another way for what?" asked the captain. "Another way for reaching the highest goals of yoga. Just before this verse, Master Patanjali has listed some powerful methods for reaching pure happiness and perfect physical health. And then out of the blue, he says, 'But you could do the same thing just by asking the master for their blessings.'" "But I thought he was the master. Is there some other master here?" "He is talking about the master that every student has. He is talking about your own teacher." I had reached the captain's pride again, and it was no small amount of pride. I suppose it's the same really with any talented pupil, and it's the teacher's job to pull it out, beat it with their own kind of stick, and then put it back into the student's heart as a healthy kind of confidence. And so we began that process. His eyebrows arched up. "I'm not sure," he began. "I'm not sure I could call you a master," he said. "Why, you're not much more than a girl, really." I reached in and cooled my own rising emotions, and then I nodded slowly. "No, I'm not a master." He nodded back at the point as if it were finished. "But I am your teacher," I added. His eyes narrowed. He was getting upset. I would have to do this carefully. "You are teaching me a little. Yes, that's true," he said flatly. "But it's only because I have asked you to, and it's only because I have arranged for these sessions, shall we say." I smiled, but it hurt a bit. He didn't even want to call them classes.
I said, so really, what you're really trying to say is that you are the master here, that you are the master of these classes because it is you who have decided to have them. And then I am just someone that you use to give you the classes. You employ me in that capacity. So in a sense, I am, shall we say, your employee and not your teacher. His eyes fixed on me, smoldering. The silence said that, well, essentially that was exactly the way it was. And that's the problem, you see, I said gently, straining to be heard. Yoga cannot be taught that way. Even if this place were some fancy school, even if I owned it, and you came here for classes, even if you were paying me in some way, still the yoga would never come to you. I could never grant you the yoga, you see, even if I wanted to and tried to, unless you regarded me as a teacher should be regarded. And that is with respect, with deep respect. Oh, it's not that teachers are some kind of faultless beings. It's not that we're not susceptible to our own problems, or that students should follow teachers blindly. But we are, you see, vessels. We hold something inside us which is bigger and much more beautiful than us as individuals. Yoga, you see, it began back, long before even the master first wrote it down. And it has been passed down, poured from vessel to vessel, teacher to student, and then to their students for hundreds and hundreds of centuries. It has survived not just in book, but in living person, in the words and touch and thoughts shared between living beings, something beyond what a book could ever do. And if books are precious, and they are, precious beyond measure, the combined knowledge of generation after generation of effort and pain and mistake and revelation, then our teachers are so much more. For regardless of what we think of a teacher, regardless of the weakness and faults we may see in them, they are still the one and only door we have to the living experience of countless generations of teachers who came before. Ultimately, every teacher contains the knowledge of all the teachers before them. Ultimately, even someone as young and inexperienced as me holds the very water that was poured into Master Patanjali's by his own master, and which he poured into his own students. And in that sense, yes, I am master too. I am your master because I am your teacher. He started to say something, but I held up my hand. Again, I want you to know, I don't mean master in a religious sense, say. I don't mean that you should bow down to me or give me anything like that. What I do mean is that you should respect me. Respect me, not for me, but for yourself. It is the kind of respect and affection that one would have for a doctor who has been your doctor for your whole life, who has seen you through everything from baby colds to more serious illnesses that strike us over our lifetimes. And when a patient or a student has this kind of regard and respect for a doctor or a teacher, and I mean no matter what the teacher is teaching them, then something happens. A magic happens. It's set loose, a blessing, the master calls it. All the power of the healing, all the power of generation upon generation of people who struggled to learn and then learned and then granted the gift on to others so it would live, so they could live, all that power is released to you. And then you see the healing will happen, the yoga will work. And otherwise, if you think of me the way you have been doing, and I'm not talking about mistakes that happen like with the stick in my cell, but if you don't respect me as a teacher, as your teacher, then you will never get better. And one day you will just lose interest and go on to something else and never find out how much farther this healing can go. Not to mention, I paused to see if he would pick it up, not to mention my two men, he said softly, whose pain has become even more difficult to ignore. He sighed and looked down at the ground. The sweetness of the truth went to his pride, and they began to struggle. I cheered our side on silently. It was a long few minutes. And then his eyes cleared, and I knew we had won. "Corporal," he called to the door. The door fell open, and the corporal fell in behind it. He picked himself up clumsily and dusted off his trousers. Sir, sorry, sir. "No problem, Corporal. Tell me, is the sergeant still here?" "He is, sir, right outside the door, in fact, sir." The captain rolled his eyes a bit at the privacy no one in a jail ever knows. "Ask him to come in," he said. They came and stood at the side of the desk. The sergeant was completely sober, but pale with the effort, I think, and his hands were shaking slightly. He glanced once over at the captain's stick leaning in the corner. "Men," began the captain, I have something to say, and I wanted to say it in front of you. I want you to hear it too." The pair stood there, still as stones, and nodded dumbly. I had a strong feeling that this was the first time in all of these years that all three men had ever spoken together as a group. "Now, what I wanted to say was, he looked up at the ceiling or somewhere past that and then said quickly, "I wanted to say in front of you both that I am very sorry for what happened the other day when I lost my temper and took the sergeant's stick and hit," and he paused, and it was hard for him, very hard, I knew, "and hit," he resolutely went on, "my teacher." The words came out once, and then it was easier. "My teacher, Miss..." He stopped abruptly, and I feared for the worst. I glanced at the sergeant and the corporal. They were glancing nervously at me, and then we all looked back at the captain. "Why," he blurted out, "I don't even know your name." I was stunned for a moment. "Well, why, it's Friday." No, he said back to me. "Your name. I need to know your name. I already know what day it is." "Oh, no," I stumbled. "I mean, you see, my name. It's my name. You see, my name is Friday." The captain sat with his mouth open for a moment, and finally it sunk in. Oh, I see. Well then, men, I want you to know that I'm apologizing. I'm apologizing to Miss Friday, to my teacher, Miss Friday." The sergeant and the corporal stood dumbstruck, their mouths still open. And then the captain came back to himself and thundered, "Sergeant, corporal, have you no work to do? Duty calls. Dismissed." And they fell out the door almost the same way they'd fallen in, and we did our giving and taking for them. And then I took my new student through a series of poses designed to make him nearly as sore as I was. Chapter 23, Pride Before a Fall. A week later, I was just walking into the captain's room for class when the corporal burst in past me, brushing against my back. I winced. The yoga I did every day had probably kept me from being crippled, but things still took time. "Pig!" cried the corporal. "What?" roared the captain. "I mean, pig, sir," returned the corporal. "What?" the captain said again. "Pig, big pig, sir." "Corporal, what pig?" "Big pig, sir. Big pig on the front porch. Can't get him off, sir." "For goodness sake, corporal, if you can't get a pig..." "Big pig, sir. If you can't get a big pig off the porch, corporal, then for goodness sake, just ask the sergeant to come out and take care of it like he always does," he said, throwing a glance in my direction. The corporal stood silent for a moment, his mouth working, but nothing coming out. "Sir, the sergeant is already on the scene of the incident, sir." "Then just tell him to do this thing, you know?" The captain looked over at me significantly, but as usual, it went over the corporal's head directly. "Not possible, sir. You see, the sergeant, sir, I believe he has burned his stick, sir." And with that, the corporal peered at the door to see if the sergeant might have heard.
I imagine that even without a stick, the sergeant knew how to express his dissatisfaction over someone snitching on him to the captain. "Oh, blast it!" exclaimed the captain, and he sailed out to the porch with the corporal and I in the wake. He asked the sergeant to step aside. He leaned down, threw his arms around what was really a rather immense pig. "Sir," cried the corporal, "you're back," cried the sergeant. And the captain just squatted down in a nice uneven pose and hefted up the beast and carried him out to the road and sent him on his way. He walked to the porch with a huge smile, stopped there near the bottom of the steps to slap some non-existent dust off his hands, and his two admirers looked on. And then for good measure, he threw his foot high up on the railing and fussed with his shoelaces for a moment. "Back to class," he grinned at me importantly, and we walked back between the two awestruck assistants to the captain's room. Before he had even sat down, I said, "Captain, sir, you shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have done that at all." He gave me a surprised look. "Oh, but it was nothing. No problem at all. My back, really, it's doing magnificently, you see." "I'm not talking about your back," I replied. "I'm talking about your foot, about showing off, when you swung it up so high on the rail, just to show off." "It wasn't exactly showing off," he began. "It was showing off," I answered. And then I held my hand up to my chin for a moment, thinking how to say it. "Here, come out here in the middle for a moment," I said, and he came around to stand where he usually did for the poses. "There is something I want you to see. It's a thing called focus. Now, we'll start with the Warrior of Excellence pose, the version where you are standing with your feet wide apart, bending at your knees, holding your arms out straight to both sides." He took the pose, and then I said, "Notice first how you feel." But I knew exactly how he felt, straining in the legs, straining in his breath, his eyes darting over to me once and then again to see if it was time to stop. "Hold your head up very straight now, neck as straight as you can make it too, and gaze out towards your hand steadily." He did so for a breath. "Now, focus your gaze on your finger," and another breath passed. "And now on the tips of your fingers," and I let two breaths pass. "And now on one fingernail," one more breath, "and then the fingernail of your middle finger only," two more breaths. "And now on the end of that fingernail, that curve of the fingernail at the end," and he did that for three breaths. "Good," I said, "now relax." He stood up straight and looked at me steadily. "That's the longest you've ever held that pose," I said, "twice as long as before." He raised his eyebrows. "Sure didn't feel like that," he mused. "It's the power of focus," I said, "and the master says, locking the mind on an object is focus. And once you've chosen the object and locked in on it, then you try to stay there, stay with it. Then the focus changes into fixation, which the master describes in the very next line in his book. And staying on that object over a stretch of time is fixation. Again, you should understand the principle. Remember that the place where the body and mind meet is deep within the channels, where your thoughts are riding like horsemen on the inner winds. Now, normally, our thoughts are flying around every which way. They're flitting from one object to the next like a fly. Land here, touch the object for a second, take off, land on another object, moment by moment, throughout the whole day. And the restless flitter of the thoughts is reflected in the inner winds, which then tend to crowd up at the choke points, tightening the knots there, and immediately damaging that part of the body located around each particular choke point. This is precisely why people whose everyday work demands constant bursts of thought in different directions with constant interruptions of their focus begin over time to exhibit the same sorts of physical problems. Problems with their hearts, ulcers, baldness, all connected to certain subtle choke points that are aggravated by the very disruptions of focus which their work requires. It's also why not being interrupted for a good period of time, getting a chance to sit down and focus on one thing like a good book or your favorite music for some time, is so relaxing.
The focus and the fixation in the focus, staying there, has a calming effect on the inner winds. I paused. Which takes the pressure off the choke points? Relaxing their grip on the middle channel, and then happy thoughts are free to flow again, he finished for me. That's the idea, I said. So you see, focusing the mind and fixing it there, so it is still, has the same effect on the channels that we are trying to achieve with the yoga, with the poses. So if you can do both at the same time, knock on the pipes from the outside with the poses and very steady breath, while you work on the inside of the pipes by stilling your mind, by focusing it on one object as you go through the poses, well then, it's much more powerful. It will make you and your back even more healthy and calm your mind down too. And that's all the trick there is to it. Pick a spot to focus on while you hold the pose. Traditionally, it could be part of your body that you're facing anyway, say the tip of your finger or toe. But you can also gaze beyond your hand, for example, to a point on the wall. And then it really is a tremendous help if you narrow down the focus to a particular little spot, say part of your fingernail or a tiny mark on the wall. Try very hard to hold your eyes there without moving them the slightest, during the whole time you hold the pose. This is a very simple and profound way of staking the thoughts down to a single place. And later, when you're doing the silent sitting, for example, or even just trying to concentrate on solving a problem at work, you will find that the habit of focusing and fixing your mind during the poses carries over to every part of your day with wonderful results. Because people who can really focus are just better at whatever they do. They succeed more and they have more fun doing it. The captain nodded, and then his forehead creased slightly. Oh, I said, just to remind you that while you focus, you remember to keep those 3 points very loose. The smile, the forehead. It defeats the purpose if you center in on a point of focus with a frown and scowl that locks up the very important final intersection of the channels between your eyebrows at the lower part of your forehead. He tried to uncrease his forehead, but the effort to concentrate on this just made the crease deeper. It takes practice. You were wondering, I think, what all this has to do with the pig, I think, I said. The big pig, he corrected, but he nodded. Well, you see, it's that focusing and fixing the mind is a double-edged sword. If you focus it on something neutral, like a spot on the wall, then it has a very calming effect on your thought winds. And if you go further and focus it, say, within a choke point itself, or even better, on a kind of thought, or a kind thought, say on how what you're doing could help the sergeant or the corporal, well then even during the poses it has an even more profound effect. And ultimately, the master goes on to say, you could even do these at the same time. Go one step further and focus, say, on the ideas we were talking about with the pen, on stopping the ultimate negative thoughts that stream constantly through the channels, the side channels, all even as you do the poses. This, though, takes a little more explaining, and it will come. Later, he smiled. That's right, I nodded. But now, suppose that instead of focusing on one of these positive things, you focus, say, on your leg, how high you're able to lift it, and how it will impress people who are watching if you lift it. The captain blushed a bit and looked at the floor. Well then, ironically, you are sending a negative thought, a thought of pride, of a competitive thought, a comparative thought, right down to your leg, just by focusing on your leg as you entertain the negative thought. Do you see? I exclaimed. He nodded. And then, with your own mind, with your own thoughts of vanity, you are actually starting to damage your physicality. You are beginning to injure the very part of you that you are vain about. And then, one day, all the negative thoughts and the power of the winds tied to them reaches a level where the very same part of you that you were so vain about gets a new choke point, and that triggers an actual injury, whether it's a pulled muscle or a joint popped out of place, or even just some ugly wrinkles on your face. And so, it's really true what they say about pride coming before the fall. it's not just that the feelings of vanity about how you're getting more slender, more muscular by doing the yoga poses are unattractive. They are. And it's not just that they distract you from the original goal that you have promised yourself to, healing yourself with the yoga so you can help others heal themselves too. It's that doing your yoga for the wrong reasons, for self-centered, selfish reasons, can actually hurt you and defeat the very purpose of yoga. So no more showing off, I concluded. I'll try, he smiled. And we did our giving and taking for the men, and then some very good yoga together.